Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Today is February the 14th, and we are in Parshas Pinchas. We're up to page 888, but we have to cover one point that we left from last time, which was how to deal with wills. The issue that we have with a will is that we learned last time about the way Yerusha, or the way inheritance works in the Torah. And inheritance is an automatic thing. That as soon as the person passes away, immediately there is an inheritance that goes to whoever the first person in line is, or first people in line are. And that is an immediate thing. It's not something which requires any sort of acquisition or any sort of action. It just happens. So unlike, let's say, a sale. So with a sale, there has to be some form of kinyan, of acquisition. So if I'm selling you my car, so there has to be at some point when the ownership transitions from me to you. And that will happen when the proper kinyan, the proper acquisition takes place. So that might mean when the payment is made. That might mean when I give you the keys. That might mean when you turn the car on. At some point, there's going to be some transfer of ownership. But something has to happen for the transfer to happen. If you and I just agree that I will sell you my car, that doesn't make the car yours. Just because we agreed about it, we have to actually do something to make it happen. That's not just true in Torah law, that's true in all legal systems. Something has to make the transition happen. A marriage doesn't happen by itself. Just because two parties agree to get married, and even if there are witnesses, that doesn't make them married. So we know what we do is the ring has to go from the husband to the wife, the chasen to the kal has to go to her. So there has to be something to trigger an acquisition. That is not true with Yerusha, with inheritance. Inheritance is without any act of acquisition. With the death of the person with the estate, immediately the estate transfers ownership. There's no delay, there's no probate, there's nothing. It just goes straight from the owner to the inheritor. Now, the courts may have to step in to figure out who the inheritor was, but they're not figuring out who gets it now, they're figuring out who got it with the death of the person. So since that's the case, so that makes it complicated, because how do we preempt that with a will? How does the will stop that from happening? So the simplest way to understand it would be, although you'll hear in a moment that it's not going to be so simple, but the simplest way to deal with it would be that what if I gift everything I own to whomever I wish? Let's say, the Torah says the boys inherit, but I have girls also. So I want my boys and my girls to inherit equally. So what I'll do is, I won't use inheritance. What I'll do is, I will gift my assets equally to my children the moment prior to my death. Now, I don't know when my death will be. 120 years. I don't know exactly what moment it's going to be, but I'll make I'll write a document and I'll have it acquired. You know, I'll make it all legal, and I'll say that this acquisition should take place the moment prior to my death, whenever that is. Okay, so that way it will preempt inheritance. Because what will happen is, if Reuven says that I want so and so, so and so, and so and so to equally have my assets a moment before I die, so that means a moment before he dies, whenever that is, all his assets get divided up amongst those people, and when he dies penniless, because the money's already given out prior to his death. So the way that preempts inheritance is, it's not inheritance, it's a gift. You can gift anything you want to anybody you want, whenever you want, as long as a person is still alive. So a person can gift their assets to whomever they wish a moment before their death, And then when they die, the inheritance will still be an inheritance. Their inheritance would go to whoever the next of kin is, but there's nothing to inherit because the money was already gifted prior to death. That would be a loophole, a way of getting around the inheritance. It's not really getting around it. It's setting it up that there's nothing to inherit. So we're not changing the way the Torah says it. Yes, the Torah says the money should go to this person. But what the deceased did was that he gave away everything prior to his death and it went to other people or equally including this person, whatever they want divided up. That would be the way to handle it. And then an estate can be given out however the person wishes. The problem is this. Let's say Reuven's 40 years old, and Reuven decides to gift all of his assets the moment before his death to three different people. It shouldn't go only to his son. He wants it to go to his son and two daughters. Okay, so he sets it up that way. So he lives another 50 years. He dies when he's 90 years old. So he wrote when he was 40 years old that the moment before I die, all my assets should be given out equally to these three people, my son and my two daughters. That's great. The problem is that's only going to work for the assets that he owned when he was 40 years old. It's not going to work for any assets he acquired between age 40 and age 90. So the problem with this method is it only works up until the point that a person writes that document or makes that official acquisition. But anything acquired after that would still be subject to the Torah's rules of inheritance. So if a person can figure out right before they die and say, okay, I want all my assets to go to these people, okay, great. But most people can't do that and don't want to do that. They want to make sure that everything is set up and done and there's no issues well before there's a chance that they might die. So what's that?
Renew it every year.
So you can renew it every year, right. But that is really difficult. I mean, that just means every single year a person would have to go back to the lawyer and go back to the rabbi and just redo it and redo it and redo it, which is...
10 years, every 5 years.
Right, but then, so let's say it's every 5 years, but that means if the last time he did it when he dies was 3 years ago, whatever was acquired during those 3 years would not be subject to what he had done. So that's the difficulty that everybody struggles with how to make a will work, halachically. So the instrument that is used, generally, is one of these real creative methods, and it's based on the fact that a person is trusted and believed, a person's word has legal standing about their own assets, stronger than witnesses. Meaning, let's say witnesses say, let's say I say that I have given a gift of $1,000 to Reuven. And two witnesses say, you did not give a gift of $1,000 to Reuven. Normally, two witnesses is stronger than one person. But when it comes to my assets, my money, and I'm not hurting anybody with my statement other than myself, then my word is stronger even than two witnesses. So if I claim I gave $1,000 to Reuven, it doesn't matter what witnesses say. That's law. Law is I gave $1,000 to Reuven. My word is binding. So this is how it works. You're going to appreciate the creativity, but you're going to be surprised by how strong that admission is. This is where we do it. So Reuven has a son and two daughters. So according to the Torah, the son gets the whole thing. Reuven wants the son to get a third, the daughters to get a third, each to get a third. That's what he wants. So what he does is as follows. He says, he writes the document. He says, upon my death, that Reuven is going to inherit everything, and I am leaving instructions that Reuben is to then turn around and give a third of my assets to daughter A and a third of my assets to daughter B. Of his own volition, he gets everything, but then he should turn around and give a third to each daughter. But how do I enforce that? It's up to him. It's not mine anymore once the son gets it. So Reuven also writes, in the event that my son chooses not to follow these instructions, then I admit that I owe my daughter $10 million. Meaning he picks a number way more than whatever money he has in his estate. He says, if Reuven chooses not to follow my instructions, that's his choice, but if that's the case, then I admit, which is legally binding, I admit that I owe my daughter $10 million. Now, if a man dies and owes money to somebody, the children do not have to pay it out of their own money. A debt does not then become the responsibility of the next of kin from their own money. But the estate has to pay the debt. If there's a debt, the estate has to pay it. So what Reuven essentially does is he says, son, I'm respectfully requesting that you give a third of my inheritance to one sister and a third of my inheritance to the other sister. If you don't want to do it, I can't force you, but if you don't do it, well, I'm going to admit, which is legally binding, that I owe one of your sisters $10 million, which is way more than my estate. And that means every penny you inherit is going to have to go to that sister, because you have to satisfy the debts out of the money you inherit. So you're going to end up with zero. So it's your choice. You can either choose to follow my wishes, in which case you'll keep a third and give a third away and give another third away, or you can choose not to follow my wishes, in which case you'll end up with zero. That's the instrument that is used, and it's one of the instruments that's used, to create a halachic will. It doesn't undo the inheritance. What it does is it sets up a situation where the inheritor, it's to their benefit to follow the instructions of the will. And if they don't follow the instructions of the will, they're going to end up with nothing, not because the inheritance didn't work, but because there's a debt that the estate has to satisfy, which will leave them with nothing. So that is the creative method used most of the time to get around the inheritance. So when that's one form of a halachic will. It's the most common form of a halachic will. So what we therefore do when we write wills is we write a secular will because we want it to stand in a secular court. But then this halachic will is also written. The halachic will does not need to be included with the secular will. It's a halachic will that satisfies the beis din, and that will therefore enforce from a Torah perspective the same instructions that are in the secular will. And that's the most common way that people handle, that the halacha handles a secular will. They should work in tandem. Yeah.
So when the Bahor is supposed to get doubled.
Yes.
But we know that that didn't happen with Yaakov when he was giving it out to his sons. He passed over Reuben and Shimon and, you know, like he went all the way down to Yosef and gave it to Ephraim and Manasseh. So how did that work? Because he didn't use this debt thing.
Okay.
And then the other thing is, like in American courts, you can say all the assets that I have now and in the future, anything I should acquire.
Right.
So that won't work halachically?
Right. Okay, so let me answer the second question first. So two questions. One question is, in a secular court, one can say all the assets I have now and in the future should be subject to these rules. So that does not work halachically. It's called a davar shelo ba la'olam, something I don't have yet, something which hasn't come into the world yet. One cannot leave it. Instructions now can't affect what I get in the future. That's why we need this instrument. The other question being asked is that didn't Yaakov Avinu, didn't he bypass Reuven, Shimon, Levi, etc., and give the Bechorah, the double portion, to Yosef in giving Manasseh and Ephraim the right to be two tribes. So the answer is yes, he did, but that wasn't monetary assets. That was a right to have, to be called two tribes instead of one tribe, which is not money, and that is where he bypassed the first whatever, however money, and he picked Rachel's firstborn rather than his firstborn. So why he did it, that's obviously a whole discussion, but it wouldn't have been subject to this anyway, because that's not something which is monetary. That's a status, I don't know what you would call that exactly, but that was a status that Menashe and Ephraim are counted as separate tribes. They each get a separate stone on the Choshen, they have their separate flag, whatever that means to have a separate, to be considered a separate tribe. But the Yaakov's assets, we don't know how he divided it up. It doesn't say in the Chumash how Yaakov divided up his assets. If he followed the Torah rules, which we don't know if he did or didn't, the Avos kept the Torah before it was given, but sometimes they didn't. It depended on different things. So if he did keep the Torah rules, then Reuven would have gotten double the assets when Yaakov passed away. But we don't know what happened with that. Yeah.
Question. This is simple, but does a girl count as the oldest, or it just goes to the oldest boy, whatever the...
So the pecking order is the boys first, and if there are no boys, then girls. And that's what Benos Talafchad, that's their situation. There were no boys, so the girls got it. As we explained last time, I'm pretty sure we did, that the Chazal provided for the widow and for the daughters, so if the assets were not huge, if it was just a regular, inheritance, typically the boys would end up with less than the girls, not because of inheritance, but because of the rules of providing for the daughters and for the widow. So, yes, they would inherit, but they would have a responsibility then to provide for all the females in the family. So, if a man died and he was very wealthy, yeah, the boys would end up with more. But if he died and he was of regular wealth, then typically the girls would end up with at least the same, if not more, than the boys. That responsibility, it includes what is called mizonos. Mizonos is basically parnasa, it's livelihood, what they need to live. And it also includes a dowry to get married, which means paying for a wedding and that kind of thing. So, by our standards today, there would have to be a lot of money in there, or the man would have to pass away after his children are all married off. So then the daughters are already accounted for, and then the assets would go only to the boys.
You mentioned my second question, so I was wondering about the wife.
So it's the same thing. The wife doesn't inherit, but she is provided for. So again, the boys inherit, but then they're required to provide. That's what the Ksuba says. So as we explained last time, the females are always provided for. The males have, it's kind of like a roll of the dice. Sometimes they'll end up with nothing, and sometimes they'll end up fabulously wealthy. It just depends on how wealthy the deceased was. Yeah.
I'm kind of confused though, because in the Ketubah, the woman can inherit, or the son, wealth that he doesn't yet have. He might have nothing when he's first married.
Right. So the question is, good.
You're right there. You're telling
right.
The
good.
Future is considered
right.
Before you talk.
Good.
It's not.
Great. So the question is that the ksuba seems to include assets that are acquired after the wedding. That's because the ksuba is not an inheritance. The ksuba is a debt. The ksuba says that the man has to provide for his wife in the event of death or divorce. This amount of money has to go to her. So that is a debt. So a debt will accrue, whenever there's money.
It's not an obligation, it's a debt.
Right, that's right, it's a debt. So if a person borrows money and then they spend it and they have no money to pay back, well, whenever they have money to pay back, they're required to pay. That's, even though that money comes later, but it's a debt. The debt has to be satisfied. So that's what, like, Suba works that way as well, that it's considered a debt. It's considered a debt that precedes other debts. It's a first, what do you call it? I don't know what you, debts are paid off in order. What's that?
Amortize?
Amortize. Okay.
Prioritize.
Okay, right. So they're paid in order of having accrued the debt. So the ksuba is the first debt. I mean, unless he had debts before he was married, but, you know, from the time they're married, the ksuba is the first debt. So that's the way that it works. There is a, Rav Moshe Feinstein addressed the issue of a person who passes away and has a secular will and did not satisfy a halachic will. So then do we follow the secular will? And Rav Moshe Feinstein famously ruled that we would still follow the secular will. He writes that a person should still make a halachic will. That's the right way to do it. But even if a person did not, in the end, we will still follow the secular will. And the reasons for that are complex. And therefore, we're not going to cover it in tonight's class, partially because they're complex and partially because I don't have it clear myself. So I can't really teach it if I don't know it. So we're going to leave it at that. But that is at least the method when they talk about a halachic will. That is the most common method that is used. There are other instruments, but that's the most common one to use. Okay, so we move on now on page 888, Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, top of the page. Oh, I'm sorry. No, we're not moving on because I forgot to tell you one thing. Because it's going to be relevant to what's coming up over here. The Medrash tells us. I'm sorry. It's not exactly relevant to this, but the Medrash tells us that Moshe Rabbeinu, the Gemara really says it. Moshe Rabbeinu, in four places, took an issue that he did not know to Hashem, meaning there was something that came up and he didn't know the answer and he went to Hashem for the answer. The Benos Tzalafchad is one of those cases. They came to him and they said to him, you know, what we should inherit. If our father passed away and there are no boys, we should inherit. So he didn't know. So he went to Hashem and Hashem answered, yes, they're correct. They should inherit. So this is one of them. There are three other places in the Torah where this happens. We have already covered, we've already passed all three of them. This is the fourth one. So there are two that have to do with capital punishment and two that have to do with money. This one has to do with money. What happens to the assets of Tzalafchad? The other one that had to do with money was back in Parshas Bahaloscha where the people who were Tameh and could not bring the Karban Pesach. They were Tamei on the 15th of Nisan, and they could 14th of Nisan, and they could not offer the Karban Pesach, and Pesach sacrifice. They came to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they asked, Lama Nigara, why should we be left out? We want to do it as well. And Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know. And he went to Hashem, and Hashem told them, yes, they should have Pesach Sheni. And that's how we learned the rule of Pesach Sheni in a month after Pesach, that they should be able to also bring a Karban Pesach. That's a monetary thing, because buying the Karban Pesach, processing it, that's a money thing. There's no capital punishment there, it's a money thing. The two capital punishment cases that he also didn't know what to do, one was back in Parshas Emor with the man who cursed Hashem, and Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know what to do with him, didn't know whether to put him to death or not, and in the event that he did have to be put to death, how to put him to death. And he asked Hashem, and Hashem said he is to be put to death, and he should be stoned. And the other case was, in Parshas Shlach, was the Mekoshesh Eitzim, the one who desecrated Shabbos, which some say was Tzalafchad, who desecrated Shabbos, they knew that he was to be put to death, but they didn't know which death to use, which how to execute him, and Moshe didn't know, and he went to Hashem and asked, and Hashem said, skila, that it's stoning. Those are the four cases. Two were capital punishments, that's the one who cursed Hashem and the one who desecrated Shabbos. Two were monetary, that's the Karban Pesach and the Benos Tzalafchad. The Chazal tell us that in the two monetary cases, we find that Moshe Rabbeinu went directly to Hashem. As soon as the question was asked, and he didn't know the answer, he went straight to Hashem. In the two capital punishments, it says they put them b'mishmar, they put them in a place of guard, under guard, meaning in jail, until they could find out what to do. Moshe Rabbeinu did not rush to Hashem to find out what to do. He took his time. Now, it doesn't mean he took several days, but it means he didn't rush to go find out the answer. He took his time to go. So the Chazal tell us Moshe Rabbeinu was teaching a lesson to judges on two counts. First of all, he was teaching judges that with a monetary case, you try to deal with it directly and quickly. With a capital crime, you work it out patiently. You don't rush to judgment with a capital crime. Don't move so quickly. Make sure you've got everything figured out with a capital crime. You have to be more careful with how you handle a capital crime. That makes sense to us. But the other thing Moshe Rabbeinu was teaching them is Moshe Rabbeinu himself did not know the answer to every question. There are four cases in the Torah where explicitly that Moshe Rabbeinu did not know the answer. And in all four cases, he went and asked Hashem, and it's recorded in the Torah. And Moshe Rabbeinu was teaching, don't be embarrassed to say you don't know the answer. If you don't know, say you don't know, and go try to figure it out. He was able to go ask Hashem. That's not everybody has that luxury, but go ask somebody else. Go discuss it. Go figure it out. But but he wanted to teach that if Moshe Rabbeinu himself didn't know the answer at times, and he was not embarrassed to say he didn't know the answer, neither should we be embarrassed to say that we don't know the answer.
When it came to Pinchas,
is that
just people got?
Yeah, so there
or,
it says.
And with the Chetzi Shekel and the menorah where Hashem had to show him,
yeah.
Are those considered different?
So, yeah, so the case of Pinchas, that was the first question. Did he forget? That's what the Gemara says. He forgot. He forgot the answer. He didn't know. And the reason why Hashem made him forget was so that Pinchas would have the opportunity to step up. But there, he didn't go and ask Hashem because Pinchas remembered. So that's a little different, because Moshe didn't know, and then Pinchas said, Rebbe, you taught us, and that this is what you're supposed to do, and he said, oh, you're right. Okay, but you figured it out, so you carry it out. That was with Pinchas. With the Chatzi Shekel and the Menorah, Hashem was telling Moshe Rabbeinu about those things, and Moshe Rabbeinu was having trouble grasping what they were, so Hashem showed him. But that wasn't the case where it happened and Moshe forgot or didn't know. It was that Moshe, in the process of being taught, he needed a visual aid. He needed the smart board for that, right? Instead of just being, right. Okay, so those are those cases over there. One other point about the Beis Lavchan, which I meant to mention last week and I forgot, was the Gemara says they were chachmanios. They were wise women. And the Gemara says, to show this, to illustrate this, that they used a very clever argument in their point that they should inherit if there are no boys. Because they said as follows. They said, look, do we count or not as offspring? Now, obviously they count as offspring. They meant legally, are we looked at as offspring? If we are looked at as offspring, then we should inherit. There's no boys, so we should come before anybody else because we're offspring. If the legal system does not recognize us as offspring in the legal sense, if that's true, then our father passed away with no sons. So that means he had no offspring. So our mother should have to have yibum. Our mother should now need to either do yibum or chalitza to our uncle. Our father's brother should now be required to do yibum to our mother, or chalitza, either choose to marry her or not, but there should be that requirement, because that rule is, if a man dies and has no offspring, so then his brother is required to either marry the widow or to do chalitza. So, you can't have it both ways, they argued. It can't be that we are offspring and our mother doesn't have yibum, but we're not offspring and we don't inherit. So they weren't saying it in a contentious way. They were saying, look, it's got to be one or the other. It's got to be either we are offspring for both or we're not offspring for both. But it's got to be one or the other. If we're not offspring, we're not offspring. Fine, but then our mother should have yibum. If we are, then we should inherit. So they presented that two-way argument, which is a very clever presentation, and Hashem said they're correct. They're right. In the yibum discussion, they are considered offspring. That is true, they are. Their mother does not get yibum. The man left offspring. He didn't leave boys, he left girls. And therefore, they are considered offspring, and therefore, they do inherit. And that argument did hold water. It was a strong argument. So they presented this to Moshe Rabbeinu when they came forward. So that's what the Gemara says. They were chachmanios. They were wise women. Now this is going to be important. We're going to come back to the Benos Salafchad later on, at the end of Parshas Masei. We will be dealing again with the Benos Salafchad because they're from the tribe of Menashe, and we're going to have another issue between them and the heads of Menashe. Again, not a contentious issue, but there's going to be this ruling here that they're going to inherit is going to lead to another legal issue, which we're going to bring up at the end of Parshas Masei. When we bring it up over there, the fact that they are considered wise women is going to play a role there as well. So we're going to put that on hold. It's going to be a little while till we get to it because we have two parshas to go to get there, but we are going to come back to this point. But the Benos Salafchad are considered to be the examples of wise women. Page 888, at the top of the page. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Alei el Har HaAvarim Hazeh, go up to this mountain of Avarim, that's the name of the mountain. Avarim means to pass by. La'avor means to pass by. So this mountain was the mountain that was a well, the topography was good for this mountain to be used as a passage into Eretz Yisrael. You had to cross the Yarden, you had to cross the Jordan River, but this mountain was on the bank of the Jordan River and it led easily into Eretz Yisrael. So go up to this Har HaAvarim, to this mountain, Ure'eyes Ha'aretz, and see the land, Asher Asati Livnei Yisrael, that I have given to the Jewish people. V'ra'isa Usa, you shall see it, V'ne'esafta El Amecha Gam Ata, and you will also be gathered into your nation, which means you're going to pass away, Ka'asher Ne'esaf Aharon Achicha, just as your brother Aaron was gathered in, just as he died, so you will die. Ka'asher Marisem Pi B'midbar Tzin, as you had rebelled against my word at Midbar Tzin, Bimrivas Ha'ida, with the arguments or the fighting of the nation, Lahakdisheni Bamayim La'inehem, to sanctify me with the water in front of their eyes. Of course, this is referring to when Hashem said to talk to the stone and Moshe hit the rock instead. Haim Meimrivas Kadesh, those are the waters of contention, the waters of fighting of Kadesh, Midbar Tzin, that were in Midbar Tzin. Waters of strife. Okay, I like that. Waters of strife of Kadesh. We know already that Hashem told Moshe and Aaron that they were going to pass away because of hitting the rock rather than speaking to the rock. We learned about that back in Parshas Chukas. Aaron has already passed away, and now Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, now you are also going to pass away, which is repeating what he had already told him back then. He already told him he's going to pass away, but now he repeats it, and he says, you need to go up this mountain in order to see the land. Moshe Rabbeinu does not go up the mountain just yet. He's going to go up the mountain, but at the end of the Chumash. In Parashas Vizos HaBracha, that's when he will finally go up the mountain, and he will see the whole land. That's where we'll learn the story of it. But Hashem is telling him here that this is what you're going to do. You're going to go up this mountain, you're going to see the land, and then you're going to die. That's where you're going to die. You're going to die up on that mountain. The other name for this mountain is Har Nivo, Nun Vez Vav. Har Nivo is the same as Har HaAvarim, which will be called Har Nivo later on in the Chumash, as we will see. We know that when the Jews traveled, the cloud that went in front of them flattened the land. It didn't just flatten the land. The cloud that went in front of them, it paved the land. Meaning, not with concrete, but it was as if it was a paved land. It made it very easy to walk. They didn't have to go up hills or down hills. There weren't crevices. It was a nice, easy path to walk on. The cloud leveled everything. The cloud also killed the snakes and scorpions that were naturally found in the desert. It cleared all that out. It made everything nice and smooth and easy. There were three mountains that the cloud did not level. One is Har Sinai, which for obvious reasons we needed the Torah, so Har Sinai was left standing. And the other two were Hor Hahar. Hor HaHor was the mountain that Aaron died on and was buried there. And Har Nivo, Har HaAvarim, this mountain for the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. Hashem left these two mountains, the mountain of Hor HaHor for Aaron's death, and Har Nivo, Har HaAvarim for Moshe's death. Those were the mountains that were left around, left standing, and of course Har Sinai for the Torah. It is not coincidental that you have mountains that are associated with the death of Moshe, the death of Aaron, and the giving of the Torah. You think like what? Those things seem to be disparate. One is getting the Torah; the other two are deaths of people. But the fact of the matter is that Moshe and Aaron, more than anybody else, are going to represent the giving of the Torah itself. Moshe, of course, is the one who actually was the recipient of the Torah on our behalf, and Aaron was the one who Moshe Rabbeinu left behind in order to take care of us while he went up to get the Torah. Of course, Hur was left behind also, but Hur was murdered with the unfortunate story of the Egel Azav, the golden calf. So these are the mountains that are left in order to accommodate the giving of the Torah, the death of Moshe, the death of Aaron. The Pasuk says in Yud Gimel in 13, you will see the land and you will be gathered in, also you. You will also be gathered in, just as Aaron was gathered in. So Chazal tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu saw, he witnessed the death of Aaron, and he saw that Aaron died with Neshika. Neshika means like a kiss, with the kiss of Hashem. So Moshe Rabbeinu was Nis'avelo Samisa. He desired that death as well. So Hashem says, you are going to die the same way Aaron died. Just as Aaron died with Neshika, with what is called a kiss, so too you will die the same way. The Gemara tells us there are obviously many ways that a person could die, and the least painful of those deaths is Neshika. It's the least traumatic way a person can die. The Gemara likens Neshika, the kiss, they call it kiss of death, right? The kiss, they liken that to pulling a hair out of milk. That's the analogy of the Gemara. We know that death is really simply the separation of the neshama, of the soul, from the guf, from the body. We know that when Adam HaRishon was created, Hashem blew into his nostrils a soul. So the soul and body were combined. They were combined in a very, very strong way. Death is the pulling apart of those two things. Naturally, we're not supposed to be pulled apart. Naturally, Adam HaRishon was meant to live forever, as were all of mankind was supposed to live forever. Once Hashem put that neshama in the body, it was meant to remain there forever. Unfortunately, with sin, there is now a requirement of death for almost everybody. There are a few exceptions, but just about everybody dies. And what death is a temporary separation of the neshama from the guf. It's only supposed to be temporary. Death is only supposed to be temporary because, of course, we have Tchiyas HaMeisim, we have the resurrection of the dead, when the neshama is put back inside the body together, and then they stay together for eternity. That's what's supposed to happen. There wasn't supposed to be death. It should have just been seamless, going from Olam HaZeh in this world to Olam Haba to the next world to what is called now Tchiyas HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead. That's what was supposed to happen, and no separation of soul from body, but because of sin, and now we have death, there is what is meant to only be a temporary time that the neshama is pulled out of the body, and the body is put in the ground, the neshama goes upstairs, and then eventually they're put back together for eternity. That's what's supposed to happen now. So that process of the neshama being pulled out of the body, that can be traumatic. That's what death is, and that's why death can be traumatic. There are different forms of death. Some are more traumatic, some are less traumatic. And Hashem, of course, is the one who decides how it's going to happen and what the ultimate reason is why some people suffer a traumatic death and some people have a less traumatic death. And that's of course, not our... We're not able to decide that, and we're not able to know in advance how that's going to be. The Gemara, in discussing what death is like, talks about pulling one thing out of another. Because that's the analogy of pulling the neshama out of the body. So in discussing what neshika is, so it's pulling the, it's as opposed to blowing the neshama into the nostrils of Adam, now the kiss is pulling that neshama out. And it compares it to pulling a hair out of milk. Just as pulling a hair out of milk, there's no trauma there. It just pulls right out. It's very simple. It's very smooth. There's no trauma. It's not hard to do. It's simple. So that is the way that Aaron died. That's how Moshe died. And that is also the way Miriam died. The three of them died with Neshika in this way, which is a very simple, easy pulling of the neshama out of the body. All other deaths are going to be either slightly more traumatic than that or a lot more traumatic than that. You know, depending, there's a whole range of how that can happen. So that is what happened to Aaron, and that is what Moshe wanted when he saw it happen to Aaron. I answered your question?
I was going to ask about
Miriam. So Miriam also. Right. Miriam also. So that is what Hashem is telling him, that you're going to die the same way that Aaron died. But the other thing he's telling him is that just as Aaron died because of the incident at Meriva, because of striking the rock instead of speaking to the rock, that's also why you are going to die. Both of you would have lived longer. You were supposed to live longer. It was not time for you to die. You would have lived longer. You would have gone into Eretz Yisrael. That's what was the original plan. But because of your sin, therefore, unfortunately, you are going to have to pass away and not have a chance to go into Eretz Yisrael. So that is also what is being said over here, that Aaron...
Was Aaron the same as Moses?
So Aaron was there as well. It seems they're both held accountable. The question was, is Aaron sinned the same as Moshe? It seems that they were both held accountable. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu was holding the stick and he hit the rock, it seems that Aaron was culpable as well. Perhaps he could have stopped him. Perhaps he also agreed to hit the rock. It seems that Aaron was included in that sin. So they would have gone into Eretz Yisrael, but they sinned. That is why the Torah emphasizes their sin. In Yud Daled in 14, it says, the reason why you're going to die is because of the how you rebelled, and in Meriva, with the water, that you didn't sanctify my name, so that's why you're going to die. The reason why that's emphasized is that one should not get the impression that Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron were somehow involved in the other sins that went on in the Midbar. That one could think perhaps they were involved with the spies, perhaps they were involved with the golden calf, perhaps they were involved with those who complained, the various other sins that went on in the Midbar, in the wilderness. So the Torah emphasizes that this is why they died. It was because of this sin, not because of anything else that went on in the wilderness. They were not involved in those things. They were completely separated. But this is why they died. So that's why it is emphasized over here. Which then leads us to the next paragraph. We'll read the paragraph. I don't know if we'll have the chance to develop it completely before the end of tonight's class, but at least we'll read the paragraph. Pasuk Tesvav, verse 15. Here we have an unusual formulation. Vayidaber Moshe el Hashem lemor. Moshe speaks to Hashem saying. That's the reverse of how you usually see it. Usually it says, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. Here it says, Vayidaber Moshe el Hashem lemor. Moshe comes to Hashem. Now this is different than the four incidents I mentioned to you before, because the four incidents I mentioned to you before were cases where Moshe Rabbeinu forgot something or didn't know something and then went to Hashem to ask. Here, Moshe Rabbeinu is initiating. Nothing happened. Hashem didn't come to Moshe. Nobody came to Moshe. Moshe Rabbeinu himself is now initiating a conversation with Hashem. And he says as follows. Yifkod Hashem Elokeihu Ruchos Lechol Basar Ish Al Ha'idah. Hashem, the God of all the souls of all flesh, should appoint a man over the congregation, a leader. Hashem should appoint somebody. Now that I know I'm going to die, Hashem should appoint somebody. Asher yetzei lifneihem, that he will go out before them. Asher yavod lifneihem, and he will come before them. He'll lead them out, lead them in. Asher yotzeim, asher yevieim, and then he'll bring them out and bring them in, which seems redundant. We have to figure out what's the difference between those statements. He says it twice. Take them out, take them in. We have to figure that out. V'lo siya adas Hashem, and Hashem's congregation should not be katzon, like sheep, asher ein lahem ro'eh, that does not have a shepherd. Don't leave your people leaderless. If I'm about to die, then appoint somebody. And we all know who that somebody is. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe. Hashem says to Moshe, Kach lechos Yehoshua bin Nun, take for yourself Yehoshua bin Nun, ish asher ruach bo, a man who has spirit. And you should lean your hand upon him. I want to emphasize that it's a man who has spirit, which is the same phrase back in Tezayin verse 16, that Hashem, the God of spirits, Haruchos. The same word is used there. That's not coincidental. We'll talk about that, Bezos Hashem. Pasuk Yud Tes, verse 19. And you should stand him up lifnei Elazar haKohen, before Elazar the Kohen, v'lifnei kol ha'idah, in front of the entire congregation, v'tzivisa uso le'inehem, and you should command him in front of them, v'nasata mehodcha alav, and you shall put from your shine, your glow upon him. Remember Moshe's face glowed, it shone. You should put some of that on him, leman yishmu kol adas b'nei Yisrael, so all the Jews should listen. This is an interesting thing that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to impart that shine, that glow, to somebody else. And we'd think that he glowed. How does he take that and give it to somebody else? Hashem says, lean on him, and some of your shine will now be imparted to him. He will now glow as well. V'lifnei Elazar HaKohen Ya'amod, he will stand before Elazar the Kohen, v'sha'al lo b'mishpat ha'urim lifnei Hashem, and he will ask of him with the law of the Urim. The Urim is the Urim the Tumim, the breastplate. That's what that you could ask the Kohen Gadol. If you were the king, you could ask the Kohen Gadol, and the letters would light up in front of Hashem. Al piv yetsu, by his word they will go out. Val piv yavo, and by his word they will come in. Hu v'chol b'nei Yisrael ito, he and all the Jews with him. V'chol ho'idah, and all of the congregation. Vayas Moshe kasher tziv Hashem oso, Moshe did as Hashem commanded him. Vayikaches Yehoshua, he took Yehoshua. Vayamideu lifnei Elazar haKohen, he stood him before Elazar the Kohen. V'lifnei kol ha'eda, and in front of the entire congregation. Vayismoch es yadav alav, he leaned his hands upon him. Hashem told him, lean your hand upon him. And Moshe Rabbeinu actually leaned his hands upon him. Vayetzaveo, he commanded him, kasher dibur Hashem b'yad Moshe, as Hashem had spoken in the hand of Moshe. It has a lot of points that need to be covered. This is the important transition of authority from Moshe to Yehoshua. Now, of course, the transition doesn't actually happen yet. He goes through this process, but Moshe Rabbeinu is still alive. So he's still the king, he's still in charge, but he has officially appointed Yehoshua as his successor. With this ceremony, this act, Yehoshua is now the official successor of Moshe Rabbeinu. Until now, we knew he was the primary student of Moshe Rabbeinu, we did not know that he was the successor of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, it is official, he is the successor. Now, everybody knows it, Moshe knows it, Yehoshua knows it, and all the Jewish people know. From this point on, when Moshe Rabbeinu dies, we are not leaderless. We don't need to hold an election. We don't have to figure out who should take over. We don't need a golden calf to take Moshe's place. Yehoshua is the man. He's the successor. That's the official point that is being made over here. Now, Moshe Rabbeinu, he clearly does this. He comes to Hashem as a response to the fact that he was told he was going to die. But Moshe Rabbeinu already knew he was going to die. He was told this back when he hit the rock. So why is all of this happening now? Why is Hashem telling Moshe Rabbeinu, you're going to die? And why is it that, okay, now that I'm going to die, well, appoint somebody else? I mean, we all knew this was going to happen. So Chazal tell us that Moshe Rabbeinu was hoping that maybe the decree would be rescinded, because he had led a war and defeated Sihon and Og, and the Jews conquered that land and annexed that land. It became our land. Sihon and Og became our land. So Moshe Rabbeinu felt like, well, I'm now part of the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. This is the area called Eiver HaYarden, the other side of the Jordan River, which is not Eretz Yisrael proper, but it is part of Eretz Yisrael, a diminished part, but it is part of Eretz Yisrael. And here I led the war. I'm part of this. I helped give out the land. I'm involved. So he felt that maybe there's wiggle room here to get out of that decree, and I can still make it into Eretz Yisrael proper. So Hashem told Moshe Rabbeinu, "I'm sorry, the decree is not rescinded. The decree is rigid. It is what it is. You're not going in. You're going to die." So Moshe Rabbeinu, upon hearing that, said, "Okay, I accept. If that's the case, then let's make sure this goes smoothly. Let's have a successor." And Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Hashem to ask him to appoint a successor, and Yehoshua is appointed. Now we still have to talk about why Yehoshua, and what's this whole business of taking in, taking out, and the shine, the glow, the hand, the hands. There's a lot to talk about over here, but that's why, that's the context of why this is happening over here.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.